On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5 KSRO.
Well, hello there, everybody. I'm George Adair. Thanks for joining us today live Wednesday in studio. Well, that's how it is every Wednesday at noon. So if you want to see or hear us, you can always check us at KSRO.com or on the Facebook. We're streaming it live right now.
Yes.
We'll be joined here shortly by our excellent guest, Dr. Eiler with Sonoma State. He is one of the deans of Sonoma State, a very well-known economist in our community. You know, I like talking with him, and we're going to get into him on with just a minute, but because he's got this local perspective,
right?
You know, he's very very involved in our community.
Exactly.
And our business
great
community.
Resource, because a lot of times you look at economic news and it doesn't necessarily pertain to us here in Sonoma County.
It doesn't, yeah. And I do my best, you know, but I'm not going to lie, I took microeconomics twice. I didn't have Dr. Eiler. But I also enjoyed my freshman year of college way too much. But of course, folks, you know, I work with a company called Cross Country Mortgage. If you ever want mortgage advice, this is the time. You can always find me at 707-583-8100 or go to georgeadair.com. Take a look at your situation, see if we have a fit. It's crazy what's happening, Michelle. Lowest rates I've ever seen. So we're seeing people, it's a frenzy.
Right. Yeah. That's why you're so busy.
It is why I'm so busy. But I'm trying to give people good information.
Yeah.
You know, and this show is really about that. Trying to give people a good perspective and understanding. So let's bring him in. Dr. Eiler, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being here on such short notice. You know, I mean, kind of like the short notice we got when the Fed decided to drop 50 bips out of the prime rate, huh?
Yeah, which was a bit of a surprise for sure.
Well, you've been, of course, studying economics and what happens in the markets and how it affects the economy. We don't see too many pandemics impact our economy very often, though, do we?
No, I mean, generally speaking, we don't see things that we even creep up from epidemic to pandemic, and so this is kind of uncharted territory in some ways, for sure.
Sure. And, you know, I think economics does tend to look at historical movement of behavior and finances and everything. And it's tough when you don't have much historical perspective. I mean, what is it? The Spanish flu? Is that the one we're looking back towards? I'm being facetious.
No, that's okay. I think that you could look at that, even though the structure of the economy is so much different than the now, and also the nature of medicine so much different than the now. The Spanish flu is a little bit maybe of an archaic example. The SARS episode and the H1N1 episodes of the recent past are probably a little bit more germane to this situation. But we haven't seen what I would consider to be this much concern globally over a virus in my lifetime, I think.
Yeah, I remember I was going to a wedding in Hong Kong. Some of our best friends got married in Hong Kong when SARS was around. I think that was like an 04, I think, or so. And they postponed their wedding because, you know, it came out of China and Hong Kong was so impacted. And I remember that, I mean, obviously that had a huge economic impact on travel that time. So this does seem to have some parallels. But this seems to be affecting the economic world a little bit differently. I mean, we're seeing mortgage interest rates fall to levels never reached before. The 10-year is below, you know, 1.0 today. I don't know where it finished at or where it's going to finish at. And stocks, they're really volatile. You know, we've seen them go up and down, 750, 800-point swings, 1,100-point swings. I would just like to kind of get your overall assessment of what's happening in the world as we watch the supply chain, consumer spending, and other issues impact world markets.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, one of the main reasons why the markets reacted so strangely and in a very pessimistic way was because they did not know how this would affect global markets based on China's role in those global markets. So the idea was that we might see a complete seizure and potentially a medium to long-term one of supply chains. And that is still a potential scenario that's bouncing around Wall Street and also bouncing around policymaker hallways.
Yeah,
where we just would not be able to get goods to market. And if that happens, then you'd see production fall, you'd see spending fall, and then you'd see government revenue fall for the time in which that was in play. So one of the things that's a little tricky to know, because China has a historic record of not being as super forthright with the data, is how much of the data we're going to get, how much of it we can believe. And so a lot of economists are sort of faulting toward the international trade data as really the way to monitor the final events, or at least the progression of events over time. Right now, we think, because we're hearing this anecdotally, and the data will come in the next few weeks, that China is slowly ramping back up toward full capacity, but may not reach it maybe through the end of quarter two.
Okay. So that's, of course, the end of June. And we're going to see trickle-down effect of the absence of manufacturing affect us through the rest of the year, right?
Yeah, and so some of the industries that are immediately affected are, I think, tourism, airlines, oil and gas, the car industry, consumer products across the board.
Yep.
We've been weeks into distribution by the nature, if you think about Amazon supply chain and what we're doing with our phones and Amazon Prime, that can leak into their supply chains in such a way to really choke off a lot of their sales forecasts, and then into consumer electronics, because all those supply chains either flow through or are affected directly or indirectly by what's happened in the major countries that have been affected, specifically China and to a certain extent now South Korea. Those are really, from, let's say, a sort of regional standpoint, the ones to worry about or really focus on. And, of course, that's where the stock market has sort of seen a lot of bleeding, has been in those focal industries.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, how does price gouging, you know, play into the supply and demand curve of price? You know, how does price gouging play in here? Are companies going to start jacking up their prices just because they can?
Well, sure. I mean, in some cases, you will see prices rise, and a lot of that is unfortunately a function of consumer behavior. So, you know, if you're watching the news and you say, "Okay, honey, this is the end game. We got to run to Costco and basically buy 17 cases of black beans because I don't know what's going to happen."
Right.
You know, price of black beans is going to go up.
Sure.
You know, if you clear all the toilet paper out of Costco, the price of toilet paper maybe go up. So
there's a nice correlation, you know, there between those two.
but you know what I mean, in the sense that if you just think about, you know, some of the staples that people are going to run in and want to buy, with the idea that if this is going to be a 2 or 3 month episode where I'm basically not going to be able to do anything per normal, that can lead to prices increasing simply because markets are going to play it out like that. So one of the things that we don't know yet is how our inventory levels can kind of backfill what may not be coming off the production line from China in such a way to sort of bridge the gap, and then how quickly those inventories can fill back up. So if you actually watch those data nationally, inventories have been slowly rising.
Yeah.
And so that we may get a slight break in that sense. But what you'll see, and this is where it gets very nasty, is you'll see that as inventories, because everything's got an opportunity cost, when inventories bleed down, then investment levels bleed down, which might lead to signals in the macro economy that we're not going to have as much capacity. And that can lead to some business decision slowdowns. So a lot of it, unfortunately or fortunately, depends on how China recovers and keeps the global supply chain moving at some speed to where it's not complete seizure. What you've seen on the markets is some inkling of that actually happening.
Yeah, and does this speak to the dangers of our global economy depending so much on cheap product coming from countries that, like China, aren't sort of taking good care of their health and creating, you know, an economic impact here because our demand for cheap products is so high? You know, does it speak to the importance of sourcing our products from other countries besides just everything coming out of China?
Yeah, it does at least speak to having some diversity in supply chain, for sure.
God, you said that so much better than me. Diversity in the supply chain, exactly.
But the flip side of it is that, you know, and it's just classic economics also, is that if we buy stuff from China either as part of the supply chain or as final consumers because of the price and the quality of the goods. If the goods were terrible quality, we wouldn't pay for them even if there's low price.
Sure.
But because they're relatively low price and because they've been so it's been so easy to gain access to them, especially through technology expanding over the last 10 or 12 years, it's just grown and grown. And so one of the big concerns is that if we go away from that, prices would rise.
Yeah.
Because you might go to higher cost producers. And if you stick with it, you take on some of these risks. So we get very myopic in these episodes too, because this is not something that happens every year, but we start thinking it might happen every year. And that's also part of what the market is reacting to. Also, is this sort of a crack in the cement that we should have seen? And now that it's here, how big is that fissure? And how many times are we going to see it crack over the next few years in such a way to expose my wealth to a downturn?
Right. So it's possible that the coronavirus was really just one of many unforeseeable triggers to economic downturn. Do you see it that way?
I don't see it that way. History doesn't suggest that. But what it can do is it can expose other frailties that are inside the global economy that we would not have seen but for this episode. Mm. So the supply chain piece of that is critical.
Mm-hmm.
How smoothly can the Chinese economy ramp back up in such a way to not disrupt supply chains for a very long time and keep the flow of the economy and keep the flow of the goods going? That we're testing that hypothesis as we speak.
And yeah.
You know, if you just look at the market reaction is both institutional and sort of individual investor money, to where
sure.
You can't really read too much into that. But the data themselves will reveal how the speed at which the Chinese economy can get back to square, and that will probably set the tone going forward to prepare us for another episode if it comes. And that's the critical factor. The other thing that's boiling with interest rates falling so quickly is how is the consumer and how are businesses going to react to having relatively low cost of credit
mm-hmm.
over the next 12 or 18 months? And will that then start to stir up concerns over debt bubbles and broader economic concerns in the United States on the financial side of the house?
Yeah, that's a really critical point. Well, we've got to go to a commercial break. I'd love to talk with you more about some of these topics if you could stick around. And of course, dive into the market specifically. I actually want your opinion about why the Fed did what they did and what the long-term impact will be on that.
Sounds good.
Great. Folks, I'm with Dr. Eiler. Of course, he's a dean with Sonoma State University and local resident economist. We're going to go to commercial break. I'm George Adair, and we'll be right back.
On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5 KSRO.
This is George Adair with Cross Country Mortgage. If you're in the market to buy a home, this message is for you. My team and I are experts at providing hands-on assistance to getting your home financing done fast and with confidence. Folks, I've been helping people obtain the right financing for nearly two decades. This experience has helped hundreds of homeowners get through some challenging situations. Maybe you're a property investor, or how about a first-time home buyer? Divorces are very complicated, and you need my experience to understand what your mortgage options are. Inherited property or rent-to-own agreements are also my specialty. Financing a home is a huge transaction in your life. When combined with a challenging situation, you need the advice and confidence to do it right. If you're ready for a great lending experience, call 707-583-8100. That's 707-583-8100. Or visit georgiadair.com. That's georgiadair.com.
Cross Country Mortgage, NMLS ID 2039, and George Adair, NMLS ID 245370. Equal housing lender, subject to credit approval.
On Air with George Adair on News Talk 1350 and the new FM 103.5, KSRO.
And we're back. Thanks for joining us. I'm George Adair, doing the show every Wednesday at noon. Appreciate your joining us today. If you would like to catch the show after, maybe later today or later in the week, or share it with your friends and families, go to ksro.com, go to the Ask the Expert series, pull down my page, and Michelle's done a great job of putting up our previous shows. You can always check them out there. Remember to go to Facebook. You can come find us at facebook.com/George Adair Lender, because that's what I am. I'm a mortgage lender. And this show has a slant towards mortgage lending, but we like to talk about all things that affect your pocketbook. And that's why I'm joined today by Dr. Eiler. Dr. Eiler, again, thank you for joining us today. I wanted to kind of start this next question with, can you explain what the Federal Reserve does very, very loosely here and why they affect the interest rate market the way they do?
Sure. So the Federal Reserve, as our central bank, basically has a regulatory function and a policy function. The regulatory function is to regulate the financial markets, including our banking industry, and the policy function is to set interest rates by which banks and credit unions trade with each other in what we call an interbank market or an overnight market,
mm-hmm.
That then sets the tone for other short-term interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, they are the Bank of the United States Congress,
yeah.
In the sense that there is a loose tie, even though there's not a direct political or, let's say, chain of command tie between Congress, the president's office, and the board of governors of the Federal Reserve. But in general, where consumers end up seeing the effects of the Federal Reserve's job is when you see interest rates change like they did this week.
Right. And why did they do that? It was a surprise to everybody. Mm-hmm. I think I found out by text message from a few customers wondering how it affected them. You know, I was like, wow, yeah. They did what?
Yeah. So we got some inklings at the end of last week that global financial markets were sort of betting, and this is where it gets very weird in the push and the pull between financial markets and central banks, that they were sort of betting that we were going to see central bank intervention on interest rates, hence that would help boost equity markets back up after the big sell-off.
Like stabilizing the markets, right?
In a sense. And so, you know, there's we don't have time for too much complex on the show today, but in short, the idea is when rates fall, it should provide a better value for stock.
Okay.
So when you think about it in terms of so-called present value. So rates go down, it gives some balance to equity markets and saying, okay, now my stocks are worth more, so maybe I either want to hold or I want to buy back in. And so that we saw the buying behavior kick in slightly last week and then actually go wild Monday. And to a certain extent, it's done pretty good today.
Yeah.
Based on that, that's both first expectation and now the news.
Yeah.
But I actually, I kind of felt like that political pressure and prudence was going to end up leading to some kind of rate cut. I did not expect 50 basis points. I expected 25 within sort of a wait and see attitude.
Yeah.
Because we'd already talked about that the Fed, based on inflation data, was probably going to cut 25 basis points anyway this year.
Mm-hmm.
So the 50 was a surprise to me also.
Yeah, I found it to be surprising, super aggressive. I felt like it also pulls out some of the ammunition a little early in case they need to moderate interest rates for lower interest rates and, you know, to into the future. Do you feel that way or do you feel like it was a good move?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, and I said this, I posted something on LinkedIn when the story came out because I thought that it would give at least some perspective on it that when with this kind of a cut, given how low rates already are, it doesn't give the Federal Reserve a lot of ammunition later. And one of the most dangerous aspects of central banking is not being predictable in your movement.
Mm.
So if you're starting to lose downward possibilities because you've gotten back down to that so-called zero lower bound. If we do start to see either, you know, structural reasons why the current boom period is going to slowly come to an end, or virus reaction triggered recession, or even slight downturn, will the Federal Reserve be able to lower interest rates any further? And the answer is not much more. And will it matter? And economics has been for decades debating how low can the Federal Reserve or any central bank go and still be effective.
Yep.
So that's one of the games we're playing right now, given how low it is. And that's why I thought they would do 25 and 25, not 50 at once.
Pretty aggressive.
Give them a little room to wiggle.
Yeah, a little wait and see could have been a benefit on the 25 and do another 25 if you need to, which they're probably already going to do. Question, and you know, this is sort of rhetorical between you and I, but one of the most common questions I have when the Fed drops rates is, oh my God, mortgage rates just fell 50 basis points. Can you explain the disconnect between the various rate markets? Because sometimes people don't believe me.
Oh, no. And it can be, and you know, what's tough about the markets is sometimes it looks like that, and then other times it does not. But the way it's structured is that the mortgage markets generally feed off the 10-year Treasury's rate.
Yeah.
And so if you see the world, which has been happening since early last week, start to pile on to 10-year Treasuries in the United States with the idea that they're in sort of a general flight to safety, it starts to bid up bond prices, meaning it makes them more expensive because demand is rising, and it forces the yield, the interest rate on those bonds, to go down. And that's why the 10-year Treasury has been forced down, because there's been so much buying behavior. And there, because banks have the 10-year Treasury kind of as their floor opportunity cost for mortgage markets, meaning that they could buy into 10-year Treasuries and just have them in a portfolio, or they could provide mortgage lending, those rates tend to follow each other more closely. When the Fed drops rates, they're really dropping a so-called short-term or cash rate. They're not dropping a long-term bond rate. They're dropping a rate that should be really a cash equivalent rate or a short-term rate. Now, in some cases, you might drag down the long-term rates with the short-term rates, but more generally what's going to happen is the short-term rate is going to force a bigger difference between the short-term yield and the longer-term yield, what we call the yield curve, and sort of reorient the cost of funds, which is the short-term rate for banks to give out loans, versus that long-term, which is their revenue. So the hope is that the rates, by cutting rates, we'll actually see the long-term bond market kick back up a little bit on yield and give banks a reason to lend. When that 10-year Treasury is this low and mortgage rates are dragged down by that 10-year Treasury, banks got to scratch their head about whether or not they're going to lend or not.
Because there's their profit, their margin, there's a compression that's happening between what their cost of funds are and what the interest rates they have to deliver to the street are. And they start to go, we don't want to lend. They pull back. And also the other thing that's happened is the Fed did this to stabilize the stock markets. When the stock market starts rallying, money starts to leave bonds, doesn't it? And it starts to go into securities. And that, of course, increases yields.
Well, and that in some ways, is the magic trick of dropping the short-term rate. So if you drop the short-term rate under the belief that you will stabilize the equity markets, people will leave the bond market, taking whatever potential profits they can, put it back in the equity market, which will then lower bond prices, increase bond yields, and sort of reorient the natural order of things in bond markets so that banks say, okay, great, now I've got a little bit more marginal revenue here as a result of lending, so I'm going to get back to lending more earnestly. And, of course, with rates being relatively lower, demand should be there also. So the Federal Reserve is in a sense, doing something that has a good theoretical basis. It did seem more aggressive than was necessary.
Yeah, I think it was too. Well, hopefully we'll see stabilization, because that's really what the aim should be. And hopefully we don't see increased panic creating a pandemic that doesn't really exist yet. I think people should remember, what is it? Tens of thousands of people die of the flu every year. And, you know, this hasn't reached anything like those type of numbers. Panic and fear, selling off, sell-offs is all very dangerous, isn't it, in our marketplace?
It can be. And it's the one thing that makes markets go crazy is uncertainty. So if this was the regular flu and we had a cure, markets would not react like this. The problem is that we just don't know, and markets get very nervous when we just don't know.
Yeah. Well, that means we just don't know where mortgage rates are headed. But do you kind of get a sense that we're going to see that 10-year fall further, or do you feel like we've seen the bottom on the mortgage-backed security and 10-year treasury?
It's very tough. I think we're probably going to see it probably bottom out somewhere in the low 0.9 range.
Uh-huh.
It looks like it's going to blob around today at right about 1 at the end of the market. But, you know, again, it really depends on how much uncertainty we have. If we start to turn the corner and we don't think this is going to be a generalized problem, then the world will probably stop looking for safety in the bond market here. And, of course, as rates drop lower, you have less and less incentive to buy bonds because the yield is so poor. But if everybody's dropping rates simultaneously, holding cash is not having much yield. So you might go to something that on the margin gives you just a squeak more yield. It's going to probably get a little bit more weird before it gets fully stabilized, but a lot of it depends on if there's any case escalation and any sort of uncertainty about further seizure in the more advanced world, meaning Western Europe, here in the United States, and sort of in North America generally. That's where it's going to get a little bit more weird.
Yeah, and it seems, I'll kind of put a bookend on this, that it seems unlikely we're going to see mortgage rates go up drastically in the short term with all this instability, right?
I agree. I think that at least in the short term, you'll still see enough sort of flight for safety, keep 10-year treasuries and ultimately 30-year conventional fixed mortgage rates at, you know, relatively low levels historically. We may not see a pick back up until later in the year for sure.
Yep. So people can take their time and not hit the panic button. Dr. Eiler, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed our time together, and hopefully things will stabilize for us in this world.
For sure, George. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Dr. Eiler is with Sonoma State and, of course, our resident economist here in Sonoma County, and really great to have him. Thank you again. Okay, folks. Wow, I know there was a lot there.
There was.
Yeah.
Does this mean that people are trying to talk with you about refinancing, about new mortgages? Are you getting a lot of calls right now about that?
Yeah. So, you know, because of the mortgage rate environment that we're in, we're getting a lot of calls. The press, I will say the press has been overselling this, so to speak.
Okay.
I think that people need to be wary of refinancing just because they're going to save a quarter or 3/8 on their rate. I am not a proponent of that. There's a term in our industry called churning. So churning through. Mm. I don't churn my clients. It's costly to refinance. You start your amortization over. Your average refinance, I don't care where you go and how they spin it, you're going to spend about $3,000 to $4,000 on a refinance. Mm-hmm. Whether they put it into your loan, whether they charge you a higher interest rate and give you a rebate, whether you pay out of pocket, that's the hard cost. Mm-hmm. And if you've had a loan for 3 or 4 years or longer and you restart your amortization, you have to work that into the numbers.
Right.
And I'm going to tell you right now, you can't find a mortgage calculator online that'll tell you that. You've got to go through me. Mm-hmm. You've got to contact me. I'm going to give you a total cost analysis where I look at current mortgage situation against a future refinance. We look at the actual costs. We look at the break-even points, and we determine together whether or not it makes sense to save $150, $200 a month. That's kind of the average savings with someone who has, say, a 4% rate going down to 3.25%. Mm-hmm. It's not huge savings, but it is nice. It also depends on how long you're going to keep your property.
Right.
So these are the questions we have to ask and answer. Don't go about it yourself. Don't do it yourself lending. Don't even think about calling somebody who sent you a mailer. Mm-hmm. Guarantee you they're not from here. And you get to work with a local lender like me by calling 707-583-8100. Call me, George Adair, with Cross Country Mortgage at 707-583-8100. We've got great rates, better service, local presence. I'm here to help. Go to georgeadair.com. That's our show. Please visit ksro.com if you want to go in and take notes and highlight everything and study it and have a book club about it. Until then, be good. See you next Wednesday at noon.